This podcast is, of course, made possible through the support of our members and from Dartmouth Hitchcock. Imagine nationally ranked healthcare in your community with convenient locations throughout northern New England. World-class providers are closer than you think. Visit dartmouthhitchcock.org to learn more. Dartmouth Hitchcock is here.
Support for The Exchange weekly New Hampshire News Roundup is made possible by Eastern Bank. We're here, you're first.
From New Hampshire Public Radio, I'm Josh Rogers. This is The Exchange. It's our weekly New Hampshire News Roundup. Vice presidential candidates court grand state voters. Democrat Tim Kaine visited last weekend. Republican Mike Pence campaigned in Manchester yesterday.
Donald Trump is still standing stronger than ever before and fighting for the American people.
New Hampshire's U.S. Senate race continues to get a lot of attention. CNN asked Maggie Hassan about Hillary Clinton this week, and the tape went viral.
You think she's honest?
She has a critical plan, among others, for making college more affordable.
And the suicide of a recently discharged New Hampshire hospital patient prompts fresh scrutiny of the state's mental health system. This is New Hampshire's weekly news roundup. I'm Josh Rogers. Good morning. Joined by Casey McDermott of NHPR, Trent Spinner of the Union Leader, Dean Spiliotis, Southern New Hampshire University. Welcome all. Do join us. The number is 1-800-577-6262 or on Facebook or Twitter. All right, vice presidential candidates in town. We're 25 days to the primary, 80 days to Election Day. What do we make of the vice presidential visits to be expected in a purported swing state, Trent?
Yeah, this is Mike Pence trying to line up New Hampshire for Trump. Trump spent a lot of time up here. He did very well in New Hampshire, but there's been. I don't think this is news to anyone. There's been some trouble since then. And so Pence is back up here he had a lot of behind the scenes meetings trying to meet with activists to kind of smooth things over. And so New Hampshire's going to be a big swing state. Will it decide who's going to be in the White House next? I don't think so. But it'll certainly be a swing state, and it's going to be very important for the Senate. So Pence said he's going to be up here. Trying to win over some voters.
So you were in the meeting he had at the Union Leader. Obviously, there's been some conspicuous friction between your publisher and the top of the Republican ticket. Any sense that Mike Pence stilled the waters there a bit?
Friction is a very nice word for the I would say very contentious relationship between the publisher of the Union Leader, the Union Leader's editorial page, and Donald Trump. They don't agree, and so. Yes, that's what Pence came up to do. He sat with us. He visited us with us for about half an hour. The first 20 minutes was on the record, and we talked with him about all kinds of different issues. What was really interesting about Pence was just how incredibly opposite he is from Donald Trump. From everything from the moment he walked in the door to the interview. And let me give you a couple of examples. When Trump came and met with us at the Union Leader, it was very rushed. He came in. It was almost like he was going through the motions. He's like, okay, all right. What are we doing here? What are we doing? Let's get this started. Let's go. Pence was very different. He was there with his wife and his daughter and also the biggest Secret Service contingent that I've ever seen. And he was incredibly polite to everyone, shaking hands. Before we started the interview, he wanted to make sure that his wife and daughter were okay. It was just a very different attitude from Trump. So that's personality. And then in terms of answering our questions, he was completely different than Trump. And he even said it during the interview that I have a different style. And so where Trump is kind of brash and I think answers questions with whatever he's thinking at that moment, Pence is much more thoughtful. And so we would ask a question. He would really take a moment to think about what he wanted to say. And then a lot of reporters who have been covering him have been joking over the last week or two that he's very good at not making news. And even in our interview, he was very good at not making news. We gave him a bunch of questions where he could have really teed off. And he was, he was right down the middle with most of
his questions. Well, it's interesting. I was covering Pence when he spoke at the executive court in Manchester yesterday. And, he definitely comes across as a very practiced conventional politician, and he did the things that a vice presidential candidate is, you know, supposed to do. He met with editorial boards. He reassured core supporters. He rallied them. He said that, you know, was insistent that, you know, reports of Donald Trump's demise are sort of premature, if not out and out wrong. And he also, you know, acted as an effective attack dog at times. Let's, why don't we listen to an interesting thing he did yesterday?
I don't know if y'all saw what Governor Hassan said the other day. If you didn't, why don't we just go ahead and take a look?
I think that she's honest and trustworthy.
I support Hillary Clinton for the presidency because her experience and her record demonstrate that she's qualified to hold the job.
You think she's honest?
She has a critical, critical plan, among others, for making college more affordable.
But you think that she's trustworthy?
I think that she has demonstrated a commitment always to something beyond herself, bigger than herself.
For Governor Hassan, let me help you out. The answer is no. And that's why we need Kelly Ayotte back in the United States Senate.
All right, that was Indiana Governor Mike Pence, Republican vice presidential nominee, getting sort of a bit meta on the campaign trail yesterday in Manchester, kind of a twofer, using Governor Hassan's interview with CNN against Hillary Clinton and on behalf of Kelly Ayotte, you know, boosting the whole ticket is something that Republican or that the vice presidential candidates do. Kelly Ayotte was not in Manchester yesterday. Some other people up for big races were. Frank Ginta, you know, Chris Sununu, Frank Edelblue. Dean, what do you make of what Mike Pence did yesterday?
Sure, yeah. You know, we used the word reassure, and I think that's the operative word. I think all along, and this is in part why he was initially chosen, all along the goal has been to have him reassure voters about the campaign, particularly about Trump's temperament, his character, and his ability to be president. He's also going to throw in some of these attacks against Clinton and Obama, and in this case, Maggie Hassan. You know, VP candidates often play a little bit of an attack dog role. And you know, Trent is right. He's a very different temperament. He's got kind of that Midwestern ethos. It's a different style of politics in that part of the country than, say, you know, Donald Trump in New York City. And so there's that kind of very stark comparison. I mean, I don't know that New Hampshire is sort of their first tier of swing states. They're really mainly focused on Florida, North Carolina, Pennsylvania, and maybe one or two other states. But nonetheless, I mean, I think we're going to see additional visits because New Hampshire's always in recent cycles has been in the mix. You know, we can talk about the Maggie Hassan interview as a separate piece, or I can even go into that now. A tremendous amount of coverage of this, ostensibly an inability to answer a very straight question about her honesty and trustworthiness. And I don't quite understand why she responded that way, because we've talked to her many times in the past. I have individually interviewed her, and she's been a very strong defender of Hillary Clinton, even on things like the emails and on these other issues of character. So I don't know if she froze because it was CNN and it was a national interview. But you heard the laughter there at the rally. And so it's just a sort of a remarkable moment. And, you know, Governor Hassan does sort of have a reputation sometimes as kind of keeping her cards close to the vest, or wanting to leave herself a little bit of wiggle room in her answers and not pin herself down. But this was an example of where she should have just said yes and kind of moved on to other things.
Well, that's the thing that was interesting to me. One of the things is that, you know, unlike Kelly Ayotte, when you throw a question to her about Donald Trump, where there is clearly some apprehension about, you know, how to handle Trump. Maggie Hassan has been a Foursquare supporter of Hillary Clinton, you know, since 2008. And, you know, why she didn't just simply say, I'm going to vote for her, I absolutely trust her, I've campaigned with her, blah, blah, blah. You know, but, you know, as Casey, you've obviously been in the position of having to ask Governor Hassan questions at the State House. And, you know, anyone who's covered her has had the experience of her repeating talking points when even asked the most basic, non-controversial question, even on very small matters.
Yeah, I don't think it's an understatement to say that she is very on message all the time. But I think that kind of makes this one even more perplexing, as you said, because her message has, you know, ostensibly been, I'm pro Hillary Clinton. I believe in her. I'm a big supporter of hers. So the fact that in this case, at least, it was difficult for her to break off of any other talking points to just say, I trust her. I think she's honest on air when given three chances to do so. I think that that exchange was particularly striking. Now, it is important to note that I guess the campaign did reach out to CNN and got themselves another headline after the interview actually aired that says Maggie Hassan clarifies, yes, Hillary Clinton is trustworthy. Which I think, you know, maybe added a little bit more fuel to the fire for the opponents just in terms of kind of the,
I don't think it really
absurdity of the
it
of
just
the exchange.
Got lost in the whole thing.
But this has been something that has been a sort of a recurrent stress, and it's something that the AOC campaign has tried to capitalize on, this scripted nature of Governor Hassan at times. And it's something that it's unclear to me. This is something that the national press highlights because – you know, they're not used to dealing with her, and therefore it's conspicuous. Maybe they've heard about somebody who's allegedly a rising star in their party, and they come, and, you know, this is what they get. You know, in fairness, that CNN interview also featured Kelly Ayotte kind of dancing around some questions about Donald Trump. But, you know, do you think this is something that would have some that will have some potency with voters, Trent?
I do. I think I mean, this one specific little thing, I don't think anyone's going to remember in November. But I think it's a sign of what the bigger race is. I think you have two very popular politicians who are going head to head in a very tight race. And as much money as they may raise, as much work they may put into campaigning, the national trends are going to play out here in New Hampshire. So there's not all that much they're going to be able to do to sway voters one way or the other. I think there are going to be a lot of people who say, I'm voting for Trump, I'm voting for Ayotte, or I'm voting for Clinton, I'm voting for Hassan. And so trying to find the people who are in the middle, trying to find the people who will say, look, I'm going to vote for Ayotte, but I can't vote for Trump, or I'm going to vote for, you know, some other combination there. Trying to find those people will be incredibly difficult. So what you're seeing in this CNN interview from both of them, what you're seeing is them trying to not say anything to upset anyone. Especially because it's still early. Because, look, Trump had more than 100,000 primary voters in New Hampshire. Ayotte is not a fan of Trump. I don't think that's news to anyone. But she also doesn't want to offend the 100,000 people who voted for Trump because there's no way for her to take to win the, her Senate seat without those voters. So I think that this CNN interview was kind of a was an interesting look at what the rest of this race might look like.
I thought it was interesting that that you know Pence chose to play it, and I will say it was one of the more effective moments in the town hall. You could sense that the crowd, you know, who are largely staunch Republicans and conspicuously Trump style Republicans, there were some people seeking office there, but it was not. You know, you contrast that. I went to the organizing event Democrats had last weekend with Tim Kaine when you had up and down the ticket. It was state senators, executive counselors, Governor Hassan, Senator Shaheen, Carol Shea Porter, all up there speaking, you know, waiting for Tim Kaine. And then Tim Kaine got up there and it was very much like, you know, we are a unified party. And, you know, in terms of a moment where you really felt unity in the room yesterday, you know, that would have been a highlight. But, you know, speaking of Kim, why don't we listen to what he said when he visited St. Anselm College? This would have been a week ago Saturday.
Didn't you see how we were upbeat, positive, patriotic, can do, right? That's who we are. That's who we are. We showed America, we showed the world that's who we are. If you watched the other convention in Cleveland, you saw something very different. It was like doom and gloom and blame America first. People have said to me, that was a dark vision of America. And I've said, that was no vision of America. That was a guided tour through the mind of Donald J. Trump, which is a very frightening place to be. A very frightening place to be.
That was Virginia Senator Tim Kaine, Democratic vice presidential candidate, on Saturday at St. Anselm College rallying. You know, I think there were like 600 or 700 Democrats there. You know, Tim Kaine was another example of somebody who came to New Hampshire and did what vice presidential candidates are supposed to do. He did a couple of retail stops. He did some interviews with local press. He had apparently a successful fundraiser at the Lake House of Stonyfield yogurt founder Gary Hirschberg, where apparently he netted more than $1 million for Democrats. You know, again, does having somebody like Tim Kaine on the ground, is that going to mobilize party loyalists in a way that not having him here is going to change anything? Or is this
I don't think it hurts, to be honest. I think what you're seeing and what you've described is the Democratic Party kind of lining up and unifying the way you typically expect in a presidential election year. It has been unusual on the Republican side to see the sort of kind of hit or miss in terms of who shows up at these Trump rallies. You know, you can certainly read something into it about respective comfort levels of different politicians. It's not unusual to see that with an unpopular president, where maybe some of the down ticket candidates will stay away. But this is a new nominee. This is not Trump is not an unpopular incumbent president. So it's a little unusual to see kind of a new nominee for an open seat generate this kind of reaction among other politicians in the state. So. I think it's certainly good to have them here. I think it'll keep the enthusiasm level up for the true believers. But the thing that Pence did with the Hassan clip at his rally, that was certainly for the benefit of a little bit of fun for the supporters and true believers who showed up. But the larger national import of that story is not about Maggie Hassan. It's gone viral because it fits into a pre-existing narrative about Hillary Clinton being dishonest, and her honesty rating in some of these polls is like 12-15%, which is remarkably low. And this has been her biggest issue all along.
And I think it's also going to – I think we're going to have to see how close the polls are leading up to Election Day. I think both campaigns kind of did their duty, right? They got the vice presidential candidates here. They did the rallies. They did the fundraisers. They talked to the supporters. Now we have to see how close New Hampshire will really be. 4 years ago, if you remember, we were like the center of the universe. We had the president here. Mitt Romney was here for his last big night with the Kid Rock concert. The question will be, how close is New Hampshire? And I think based on that, the campaigns will decide whether or not – how much more time to invest. That's the biggest thing that they have, right, the candidates. So that's the biggest thing they can invest. And so will they want to spend that time here? And that's the question.
I think one of the other interesting things is just in terms of the contrast between like the Republican side and the Democratic side is that, as we said, we had – Tim Kaine up there campaigning with a lot of the down ballot candidates, on stage, being really involved in the process. That was not necessarily the case on Mike Pence's side. But what we are going to be seeing is John Kasich coming back doing campaigning for Chris Sununu in the governor's race. He said that he's going to be here to boost Kelly Ayotte. So I think that just kind of further illustrates the kind of divisions that are existing on the Republican side, where like John Kasich has not been eager to fall in line behind Trump, but he's coming in to do some of the rallying of the troops for the down ballot candidates that might need some help because of being dragged down by Trump potentially.
And sort of feather his nest for the future.
Exactly.
Well, and that's – I'm glad you brought that up because I think that's what's happening here. And I think even the Pence visit, when he sat with us, I asked him, if this doesn't work out, are you going to run for president in 2020? That's the New Hampshire question. We're supposed to ask everyone who shows up here. And I did. He didn't even crack a smile. But he did say that he would be back trying to get Donald Trump reelected. But I think the Kasich visit is interesting. I mean, I think we're seeing the start of the 2020 primary right now.
Well, and I think if Trump ends up losing, then I think someone like Kasich hopes that, the party will kind of swing back towards a more typical establishment sort of consensus candidate. And he would actually be pretty well, positioned for something like that. But, the issue would be, what is the impact on the Republican primary electorate the next time around? If it's the way it's been in recent cycles, that may not make a difference. But if there is some sort of, retrenchment in the party or kind of, purging of people who were Trump supporters and maybe they go off and form another party, maybe a good opportunity for Kasich.
And I think Kasich's hope that the party kind of heads back to being more moderate and more like Kasich, I think I'm not sure that's going to work because I saw this poll, I think it was CBS, and they asked people, do you think the GOP should be more like Donald Trump or – Paul Ryan, and Trump overwhelmingly won.
Well, that's a problem for Kasich, obviously.
Stay with us. Coming up more in the weekly New Hampshire News Roundup in just a minute on NHPR. Weekly New Hampshire News Roundup on NHPR. I'm Josh Rogers. You can join us. The exchange number is 1-800-892-6477. email exchange@nhpr.org or find us on Facebook or Twitter. All right, we're going to stick with politics for a little while longer. And, you know, we'll continue to talk about the hangover the top of the ticket has over our U.S. Senate race. And I guess specifically, I'd like to talk about the controversy over campaign tactics by an outside group hoping that Kellyanne loses in November. They had volunteers pursuing her as she ran in a 5K, which is a campaign staple of AOT's, wearing Donald Trump masks. And for those of us who haven't seen the picture, that sort of ominous looking. Can you guys have to speed on this, Casey?
Yeah, so this happened within the last few weeks. And as you said, Kelly Ayotte has been using 5Ks as kind of a campaigning, just another arm of campaigning for herself this cycle. But there were a handful of protesters from a group called 350.org, I believe. It's a climate action. That's supposed to be their main focus is climate advocacy, climate change awareness. They've been involved on the ground here for well over a year. I've seen them at town halls with Hillary Clinton. They interrupted a rally in Dover with her last summer. So they're known for kind of making a fuss at events. But in this case, what happened was there were like a handful of people who actually were like following very, very close behind Senator Ayotte as she was running through town during this 5K. And the optics of it are, I think, objectively a little bit creepy looking, like to anyone looking at the picture. It's the senator and then like a few people behind her in these kind of like weird looking Donald Trump masks. And the message of this was supposed to be that Kelly Ayotte cannot outrun her support for Donald Trump or her connections to Donald Trump. So, and what was interesting was that this kind of provoked some like cringes from both sides of the aisle. It wasn't just Republicans who were saying like, this is not okay. You had a handful of Democrats being like, this is like maybe not the best look for this organization. This is maybe taking a step too far. You did have people making parallels between what we saw last cycle or the last Senate cycle where a staffer in a chicken suit followed around Senator Jeanne Shaheen, maybe not quite as closely, but pretty closely to make a point about.
I mean, my recollection is the police
briefly interceded
in that case. But I mean, how much of this, Dean, do you think this part of this is Kelly Ayotte's a woman? You have, you know, kind of masked people running after her. We obviously have these horrible killings of female joggers
yeah.
Recently.
Yeah.
I mean, how much do you think that's it as much as the tenor on the campaign trail?
Yeah, you know, the picture was all over Twitter. And just as a photograph, it's a remarkable piece of political staging. I mean, they literally – it's just her and then these three guys running behind her. I mean, they really got the picture that they wanted. My initial reaction when I saw it was it sort of was a little uncomfortable, kind of creepy. I didn't find it particularly funny. And I wasn't sure, you know, who's doing this, why are they doing it. It was just very unclear. So – you know, I don't know how effective it was, but it was interesting to hear, as Casey mentioned, a number of Democrats voice their discomfort with it. It had kind of a creepy, stalkerish quality to it. And you make a good point, actually, about a number of these recent tragedies we've had with female joggers. I will say on the chicken suit, there's a long tradition in American politics of people dressing up in chicken suits to taunt politicians. The famous one was in 1992. George H.W. Bush would not debate Bill Clinton. So Chicken George would follow this guy in a suit that they called Chicken George would follow George H.W. Bush around to rallies and flip over a sign that says Chicken George won't debate. So the chicken suit concept has been around for many decades. But this face masks with the running I thought was creepy.
Well, I mean, as has the linkage of state candidates to federal candidates in a negative way. I can recall covering the Senate race between Jeanne Shaheen and John Isununu, and in 2008, and the Democratic Party had a van that had a picture of Sununu and George W. Bush arm in arm, and they had a bullhorn mounted on top of the van, and they would park it outside Sununu events, and it would play a clip of tape on a loop like of George W. Bush saying, I never had to ask where John Sununu stood. He was with me from the start. And, you know, this caused some friction back then. But one difference here is that we're talking about an outside group. I mean, those groups would have been like the party sent somebody in chicken suit or the party sent this. And so in terms of who can control the tactics of these outside groups, having like a senior Democrat or Republican person call them up and kind of say, you know, we don't think that's cool, you know, might not be persuasive in this day and age.
I don't think so at all. I mean, we saw a bunch of Democrats being very upset about this tactic. And, the group was still using the photo. So, you know, this is, as you kind of alluded to, this has been a tradition, right? Where you, if the national candidates are less popular than the local candidates, you try and tie the local candidate to the unpopular national candidate. And so both parties are trying to do that right now. People who have barely any connection to the national candidate besides being in the same party, the opposing party is trying to convince voters that they are hand in hand, even if it's not true. So I think we're going to see this. I think it's going to ramp up through November. Just watch your mailboxes and your TV commercials.
So I want to turn to the involvement of another outside kind of advocacy group in a campaign, and this is the Democratic gubernatorial primary. Planned Parenthood Action Fund, the political arm of Planned Parenthood, decided to get into the Democratic primary this week, endorsing Executive Counselor Colin Van Ostern. This is a Democratic field in which all three candidates support abortion rights, and Planned Parenthood decided that this is what they want to do. What should we make of this, Dean?
It was a little bit of a surprise, and it has caused a little bit of friction among activists who are involved in this community. All three are pro-choice, as you mentioned. The Planned Parenthood New Hampshire Action Fund PAC that did the endorsement says that they interviewed all three candidates and that in some sense this was a reward for Colin Van Ostern defending Planned Parenthood funding on the executive council in recent years when we've had these various dust-ups over contract renewal. So they just felt that he was sort of the most aggressive in supporting their agenda. You know, they've become more politically active in recent years as a lobbying arm. And so I'm not surprised to see it, but I'm also not surprised to see that it's ruffled some feathers.
Well, I think it's surprising that people think there's still a Democratic primary, at least if you ask the Van Ostern campaign. They think they have this thing wrapped up. They've got a lot more money than all of their competitors. They have all the support they have a lot of support from unions, including the state employees, from special interest groups like Planned Parenthood, Sierra Club. And so they are spending the next month, at least from what I see, they're spending the next month trying not to make a mistake because they think they have this thing locked up. They're not even coming in to sit down with the state's largest newspaper for an interview. These are pretty basic get-to-know-you kind of interviews, and they don't even think they need to do that. So I'm sure that they have numbers that show they're doing very well, and with the Planned Parenthood endorsement, it seems like they think, at least, that this is locked up.
Well, it was interesting because Mark Connolly had a call that his campaign used, including women who were long known as staunch pro-choice advocates in New Hampshire, Mary Rao, Katie Wheeler, DNC committee woman Martha Fuller Clark. And it is interesting to the degree to which you can see maybe a generational difference in the politics within Planned Parenthood of people who came up when the organization didn't get into primaries when everyone supported abortion rights or didn't campaign against Republicans who are broadly supportive of abortion rights. And, it's possible the stakes have changed for abortion rights across the country and that there are fewer and fewer Republicans who will identify themselves as supportive of abortion rights and supportive of Planned Parenthood providing services under government with government money, which has obviously been a flashpoint here and across the country. But Casey, do you think that we're at a moment when the politics around abortion rights are particularly intense or whether the ground is changing in any way?
Well, I think what we're seeing is that the Democrats want to continue to make – and Planned Parenthood PAC wants to continue to keep this issue at the forefront. So in some ways, I think this endorsement was maybe like a preemptive move setting up for the general election, no matter who the Republican candidate is that the Democrat is going to be facing off. If they do believe that Colin Van Ostern is going to win the primary, then – what we've seen for the last few months, even before they had this endorsement, was the Democrats and Planned Parenthood advocates really wanting to make a big issue out of, Chris Sununu's votes in particular on the Planned Parenthood contracts and really painting the entire Republican field as anti-choice. So I would read this more as kind of a long game play for them, just leading into November and continuing to keep this kind of messaging at the forefront for that.
And it's worth remembering that the National Planned Parenthood Action, took the steps that they never had of endorsing
right.
Hillary Clinton early in the primary process. But I wanted to touch another story that was reported in the Boston Globe in the Democratic primary, which was Mark Connolly, a former state securities regulator, a letter he wrote soliciting donations and support from former fraternity brothers of his at the Dartmouth frat house, Alpha Delta. Why did this draw attention, Dean?
Because he's a candidate for governor. This frat has a very sort of checkered history at Dartmouth. The governor is an ex officio board member, I believe, of the Dartmouth Board of Trustees. Connolly's in a little bit of a tough spot here. I think what happened was, he's a member or former member of Alpha Delta when he was at Dartmouth. He's a Dartmouth alum. He was a member of this fraternity. He was on campus. I think he probably got a little sentimental about his experience there. Said it was, some of the best years of his life. Alpha Delta is sort of known as the model for Animal House, right? I think the fellow who wrote Animal House was an Alpha Delta member or something like that. In any event, they recently got kicked off campus finally by Dartmouth after there was some students that were branded with the fraternity letters on their bodies. Dartmouth has said they're permanently derecognized. Connolly has sort of walked it back a little bit and, just sort of tried to put it in context and said that he would not, if he were governor, he would not let his position on the Board of Trustees have an impact on this at all. But he has a little bit of a unforced error, I guess, kind of couched in the nostalgia for his years at Dartmouth.
And certainly the timing of it coming as, the Planned Parenthood endorsement of Van Ostern and the importance of women voters in general, but particularly in the Democratic primary, this was not great.
It wasn't great. I mean, you're in a tough race already. You don't want to spend a week talking about Dartmouth frats. And that's what ended up happening.
Another development in New Hampshire politics that, was interesting to see the name back in the news, and apparently Jerry DeLamis, a New Hampshire Tea Party activist, a man charged in the Bundy Ranch standoff, has signaled he's going to be pleading guilty on some serious charges. We're going to get the details on that next week. But I was in the federal court before he was sent out to Nevada. And, Jerry DeLamis's supporters and he himself indicated that it was going to be, sort of standing strong to the end. What do you make of this trend?
Okay,
inevitable?
No, the speculation is that there's some kind of deal on the table. And I would imagine that it somehow involves time being spent here in New Hampshire rather than out west so that he can be close to his friends and family. Or maybe it doesn't include time at all. I don't know. So that's pure speculation. I just want to say that. We aren't going to find out what the details of the plea agreement are until next week. But you're right. They wanted to fight. Even Frank Ginta sent a letter to the court saying that Jerry's a great guy. He would never do anything to harm his country. And so they were preparing for a big battle in court. And so something happened. And I don't know if he was never accused of being a top level person at the Bundy Ranch.
Was mid-level organizer.
Very, but they're very also, mid-level.
I mean, some of these pictures of him, and he's a former Marine, and there are pictures of him on Facebook, standing with this, very large military sniper style rifle, cocked at his hip. Walkie-talkies, wearing military outfits. And you can certainly see that the federal government, would have reason to look askance at that.
Sure. I mean, what the federal government did was there was a long standoff at this Bundy Ranch, and they went and they found everyone who was involved. And they indicted people, including like Jerry, who, for example, I think the indictments were that he helped organize a couple of people and told them to stand in a certain spot. So they indicted him on, I think it was like crimes against the U.S. government or organizing against the U.S., pretty very, very serious charges, felony levels. So I would imagine that what the federal government did was kind of cast a broad net. They indicted as many people as they had evidence to indict. And then what they're trying to do, I think, is cut deals with folks who will probably be willing to testify against the Bundys. So anyway, that's all speculation because we don't know what the actual deal is. But it was very surprising to see a deal being announced.
And Jerry DeLamis was somebody, was in some ways an indicator of Donald Trump's, appeal to very staunch Tea Party activists at a time when Donald Trump, how he fit into the Republican Party was unclear. Jerry DeLamis was one of these people who was you know, very much constitutional conservative in his own words, somebody who said the founding principles of the country were the determinative factors of, you know, the sorts of candidates he supported. And I have to say I was surprised, and I, you know, took that as an early indication that, you know, Donald Trump's ability to appeal to, you know, staunch conservatives, you know, might be more persuasive than it was originally perceived to be in New Hampshire.
Yeah, absolutely. And I think, you know, this is one example of that. We can also talk about Al Baldessaro, who's been in the news yet again, clarifying his remarks about Hillary Clinton, that he's not calling for Hillary Clinton to be assassinated, but he does think she should be shot for treason because of Benghazi. And he has now tripled down on this and seems to have no intention of backing down on it. So, yeah, I mean, I think there is a sort of element of Donald Trump's campaign that really connects with what we would have thought of traditionally back in 2010 as kind of sort of the Tea Party crowd. And Jerry DeLimas, there was sort of a lot of evidence of, you know, him driving out there and saying he was willing to fight and being involved in the organizing. But Trent is right. I was surprised as well when I saw that he was going to plead guilty. I thought this was going to go on for a while. So interested to see what the details are next week.
Some comments from Facebook. I listened to the Maggie Hassan interview and something about the sound seemed very edited. I looked up the video and I saw... think that all of us see what we want to hear, but the interview is clearly edited to show the newscaster asking the question repeatedly, but what happens between him and the camera is clearly edited out. I'm not a forensic analyst, but I think we can see the substance of her back and forth. And another comment regarding Kelly Ayotte is, interesting comments concerning Kelly Ayotte. While the jogging incident may not have been in good taste, what's more upsetting is that Kelly Ayotte gladly accepts tons of money, out-of-state money from donors. That is very troubling. There's a lot of out-of-state money. Kelly Ayotte accepts a lot of it. So does Maggie Hassan and pretty much anyone else who's running for national office. After the break, we're going to turn to stories that are not explicitly political, but I do want to note that this weekend both Democrats and Republicans are going to be out organizing. The Trump campaign is having a day of action. You know, it's one of their first grassroots organizing efforts. You know, Dean, do you make of that this is a little late to be getting going?
Well,
there?
It seems a little late. Certainly this has been one of the criticisms, is that they're not organized on the ground. There have been a number of articles saying that they don't have ground operations in a lot of states, that, you know, we know that Trump has enjoyed campaigning sort of via the news cycle and you know, having rallies and trying to sort of ride the news cycle. You know, maybe it's indicative of some of the changes in the leadership there, particularly Kellyanne Conway coming in as a campaign manager. But they've got a lot of work cut out for him. I mean, they have, I think, on the ground here less than a third of the paid staff in comparison to Hillary Clinton. So they've got a lot of work to do. Is it too late? Maybe. They're certainly working at a deficit in a number of these swing states.
It is 80 days until people head to the polls in
not
the general
a lot of time
election.
At all.
25 days to the primary, lots of politics between now and then. When we return from the break, we're going to talk about stuff that is not explicitly political for change on the weekly New Hampshire News Roundup here on NHPR. Please join us with comments, 1-800-892-6477. Find us on Facebook or Twitter. We'll be back after a break. Weekly New Hampshire News Roundup on NHPR. I'm Josh Rogers. As always, do join us. The exchange number is 1-800-892-6477. Email us exchange at NHPR or get to us on Facebook or Twitter. All right, we're going to turn away from politics for a moment to a tough story. Suicide of a discharged New Hampshire hospital patient. Governor Hassan says there's going to be a public component of the review of this incident. Often these reviews are confidential. And you know, this comes at a time when the state's mental health services, or lack thereof, are getting attention and mental health staffing levels are being questioned. Trent, I know your paper sought the identity of the patient under the Right to Know law. Any sense of how far this review is going to go?
Sure. You know, we've talked to people who say that this is going to be a comprehensive review. Just to give some background on the story, last month a 63-year-old woman jumped from the third story of a building in Nashua. She leapt to her death. She had just been discharged from the New Hampshire State Hospital. She had literally just been discharged. While she was at the hospital, she had a plan to commit suicide. She was open about committing suicide. There were open beds available at the hospital. She was still discharged and within hours was dead. So, you know, they call this a sentinel event, which basically allows a discussion about what went wrong. Is there something we can do in the future? These are usually not public. But we have pressed the government officials to make at least some part of this public. I mean, there's a state law that that the Department of Health and Human Services points to that basically says we don't have to tell you anything about what happened here. But we're in the middle of a big contract dispute at the state hospital. There are staffing issues there. So we feel like the public has a right to know about what went wrong and what can be done in the future to make sure something like this doesn't happen. So we're going to be covering this case extensively.
So as you mentioned, the contract dispute over the mental health staffers at the hospital, the executive council slated to vote on a contract that would put Dartmouth Hitchcock in charge of medical staff at the state hospital for 3 years. Until earlier this year, Dartmouth Medical School had been doing that. And, you know, there's been some talk. Mayor Ted Gazzis, I believe, wants that put on hold. You know, there have been sore feelings on this. Dean, do you think that where do you see this going?
Hard to know. And I know there as you mentioned, initially there was sort of a temporary contract, and then the Health and Human Services was going to bring forward a decision about, you know, whether to go back out to bid or offer Dartmouth a permanent contract. And they sort of fairly quickly moved to try to make this contract for the state hospital with Dartmouth permanent, and that's going to be the vote on the supposed to be the vote on the executive council next week. So I am very interested to see whether they decide to put that off a little bit, because, you know, the way that Trent laid it out there certainly is a concern. And so this may you know, have some political legs to it, and we'll see if they may very well put off that vote.
So Casey, obviously you've spent some time looking at the New Hampshire hospital, and you know there are very strong feelings on both sides of this issue about whether or not there's adequate staffing, adequate beds. It seems that there may have been adequate space to keep the woman who committed suicide in the hospital longer. You know, do you think that we're going to be seeing a long-term debate over the future of how services are delivered in New Hampshire, or this will...
I think we have been seeing a long-term debate over how services are delivered. And I think this incident, I would assume, would kind of exacerbate existing concerns about the state of the state's mental health system. Obviously, there was that big class action lawsuit a few years ago just about providing services at the community level. A number of the reforms that were laid out as part of the settlement for that have been lagging.
Yeah.
Had not been fully implemented, and I think a lot of people in the mental health community may point to, you know, those delays as, you know, creating a system where maybe, you know, people who need the help that they, you know, that might benefit them before it becomes kind of a situation that would escalate could benefit. I don't know, you know, how it's going to play out from here, but I would imagine that this would just serve to kind of, you know, bolster arguments that more needs to be done to kind of change the system and provide more access at a number of levels for people who need help.
And just one thing I want to note here is that, and this is a small plug for local news. Were it not for local news covering this story would have never gotten out. State law seems to indicate that even if there was a lawsuit, that none of these records would ever become public. So the public would never have an opportunity to see this case or hear about it, to hear about this 63-year-old woman who literally jumped to her death after being discharged from the state hospital that had an open bed. So, you know, just a small plug for local news. This is not something that you would be able to find for free on your Facebook feed.
All right, Trent. Another story in which in which mental health it plays a role that is going to be getting some scrutiny this time potentially from the federal government is the way New Hampshire people who are civilly committed and considered dangerous are treated in New Hampshire. They're placed in a psychiatric unit at the state hospital. you know, there's been a complaint filed by a state lawmaker and by a patient's rights group. Dean, this is a story that's been going on for a long time, this setup we have in New Hampshire. And it's not a setup that most states have.
Yeah, I'm not as familiar with the setup that other states have, but it has been something that has been discussed for a while. There's been a number of these kinds of issues with the sort of prison system, with the amount of staffing, with the sort of putting these individuals in a sort of separate psychiatric care like that. So I'm not sure how it's going to play out down the road, but this has been a discussion that's been going on for some time.
Well, the complaint said, among other things, that, quote, the state of New Hampshire is systematically and intentionally violating the Constitution as well as the civil rights and civil liberties of a very vulnerable population. Apparently 13 people a year find themselves in that circumstance, according to the Department of Health and Human Services. The state's posture has been that the prison psychiatric unit is adequate, and where the civilly committed are held is a treatment unit, you know, not in cells. But, you know, does this just get back to budget pressures? There have been recommendations through the years that the state take these folks out of the state prison setting. In listening to lawmakers talk about the budget and sort of what may end up being, I mean, who knows where we're going to be on the surplus at the end of the year. But, you know, when you've been listening to the people running for governor, Casey, have you been hearing any talk about addressing a problem like this or no?
Not overtly. I think you hear candidates talking about kind of, you know, building, addressing mental health, addressing substance abuse. But I think that the larger themes of the gubernatorial campaign, at least, have been focused on the economy, on the opioid crisis, which, you know, does tie into mental health in a big way. But this has not been an issue that I think you're seeing a lot of headlines in the current campaigns, and perhaps, you know, that is, you know, part of the reason why there is a lawsuit now to kind of draw more attention to it.
Most of the discussion about this sort of these prison issues has really revolved around budgetary issues with sufficient staffing. And then we had the lawsuit and the resolution with the new women's prison and kind of the sort of equal facilities and treatment for men and women has not really been mixed into the general discussion on mental health all that much. And so this is sort of a fairly kind of specific variant of issues surrounding the sort of what are provided to people who are in our various prisons in the state.
I mean, I would expect that these will come up for whoever is governor in the next, consideration of the state budget. But, there is, certainly the political stakes potentially for Maggie Hassan, who, you know, whether or not you're directly involved as governor, you're sort of sitting atop the food chain in state government. And I know that, you know, she has been she has said that she's been, you know, responsible in addressing, and entering into the mental health settlement. And, you know, this is something that she has spoken about. It'll be interesting to see whether this, you know, sort of crops up the next 80 days as a political issue.
That's right. And I think what people are going to be looking at, I can tell you at least what we're going to be looking at, is how she did as governor. We're going to be looking at Health and Human Services, including mental health issues, the state prison issues. We're also going to be looking at DCYF. There have been a number of tragic cases where children have died after somehow being involved in the DCYF system. And so, yes, the governor is obviously not involved day to day in any of these things, but she's the chief executive of the state government. And so we're going to be looking at all of these things to help voters compare and contrast, how she did in state government and also what Kelly Ayotte did in the U.S. Senate.
Join us. If you have any comments or questions, 1-800-892-6477, The Exchange, or by email at exchange.org or on Facebook or Twitter. One more story involving sort of justice in the court systems, and that are developments in the civil suit against St. Paul's School brought by the family of the former student who was sexually assaulted by Owen LaBrie, who was a former St. Paul's graduate. Interesting developments there this week, sort of a ratcheting up of the legal tensions over whether or not the girl who was a freshman at the time of the incident should be able to proceed anonymously in federal court. And this has interesting issues, legally, but also you know, in some ways politically in terms of the culture around these cases. You know, what do you make of the back and forth between the lawyers on this, Dean?
It's interesting. You know, this is the civil suit that the family has filed anonymously, claiming in excess of $75,000 in damages from this whole experience at St. Paul's. St. Paul's lawyers have countered and said that in this kind of civil suit, given the potential damage that the suit that this family can do to St. Paul's in terms of sort of the narrative about the problems at the school, that it should not be anonymous. And you know, I'm not a lawyer, but the comments from lawyers that I've read suggest that the law is designed in such a way that this is the kind of case where you would typically actually protect the young woman rather than make her name public. But, you know, I don't know. I don't know enough about how these cases work to decide whether, you know, is this an attempt by St. Paul's to kind of, you know, an initial play towards some sort of settlement, maybe a little bit of intimidation tactics. But nonetheless, it sounds like the law typically would protect her name. We'll see. I don't think the courts have ruled yet. But they made the case that this is just that it needs to be public because it's just sort of an unfair advantage to be able to do damage against the school yet keep your anonymity.
So they filed, I mean, pages and pages of motions saying that this young woman's name should be made public, her family's name.
And they
kind of
backed away.
No, and then we reported it, and then they said the media's got it wrong.
Right.
We don't think. And they said, you know, the media isn't reading our motions, and we pulled them up and we said, wait a second.
It's verbatim.
In
the motion.
Right. And it's signed by Mike Delaney, who former attorney general, who's now their attorney. And so we're kind of scratching our head.
This whole thing that is kind of interesting because this, you know, if you read the motion, part of their rationale for this is that they are lamenting the fact that they're being attacked in the media. Their reputation is being damaged. This is bad. This is a bad you know, bad press. But then this move in and of itself has generated a lot of, you know, negative press for the school from people who say, like, listen, this is not a good look to be trying to, like, unearth the identity of a sexual assault victim. So we'll see how this plays out moving forward. But I think that was kind of another interesting wrinkle in all of this, that this started as a way to kind of maybe vindicate the reputation a little bit, but maybe ended up damaging it more so.
And I'm surprised that they're fighting so hard to have the victim's name released, because Mike Delaney was the attorney general, dealt with the press a lot. He knows that we would never identify a victim of sexual assault.
Especially a minor.
Especially a minor.
All right. Turning to a lighter topic, but still substantial, we're now joined by NHPR's Brady Carlson, who's sat in this chair a lot and done so ably, who is sort of riding off to the Midwest to join the staff at Wisconsin Public Radio, will be dearly missed. And so we just wanted to touch base with you for a minute, Brady. I'll try not to get emotional.
I was going to bring Kleenex in for you, Josh, but I trust you can hold it together.
You've sat here. What do you want people to know as you exit the state?
Well, it's been certainly a fascinating ride for me here, coming from Illinois, a state that's not terribly known for politicians who are accessible or government run at the local level, to come to a place where, you know, I think I met the then Governor Gene Shaheen within the first month of my being here. The other first politician I remember meeting here was a then just little known state Senate candidate from Exeter who went by Maggie Woodhassen back in 2002. And just being so impressed by the accessibility and the sort of depth to which a person could get to participate in what was going on, even at the State House. You know, you could literally just walk in and be part of that. And obviously, over time, we've seen some of that change. There are parts of the State House you can't just walk through anymore. And you do, and figuratively speaking, have a little bit less access to some of the people who are making decisions in the state. But New Hampshire has remained a unique place, a place that has strong communities and strong participation. I mean, we saw that even in the last presidential primary, the highest participation rate of any state in the primary process. So even as we see some of these trends that counter the traditions of New Hampshire, like more money in politics and that sort of best practices that we've seen sort of creeping in from Washington and so forth, New Hampshire still remains New Hampshire, and I'm going to miss it.
All right. You sound like a candidate.
if nominated, I will not run. If elected, I will not serve.
Brady, I'll be interested to see when you do your first Wisconsin fund drive if you give out the New Hampshire number by accident.
There's a very good chance of that. Yeah, I'm a little bit worried that that I'm going to be start saying all of my my catchphrases here on NHPR. But you know, I think being back in Central Time may help me with that because I'm going to be getting up an hour earlier than usual.
All right, Brady. Vaya con Dios.
Thanks, Josh.
That's Brady Carlson, a longtime NHPR. You know, he did a lot of things here, hosted, ran the computer system, was always a good colleague. He's heading off to Wisconsin. Today's his last day here. We just wanted to, you know, send him off. This is The Exchange, weekly New Hampshire News Roundup. I'm Josh Rogers, joined by Casey McDermott of NHPR, Trent Spinner, the union leader, Dean Spiliotis. All right, it's that time of the show. What are you guys going to be doing next week? Casey?
I think, continue to try to keep tabs on the governor's race and just, you know, keep an eye out for developments there. And we'll also just be interested to see, you know, after all of the organizing events this weekend that the Trump campaign is doing and that the Clinton campaign is continuing to do after having been doing them for several months, just how, you know, those continue to shake out in terms of whether they're paying any dividends or getting more people to kind of join in and rally the troops ahead of the election.
We have hour-long interviews with all of the candidates in contested elections. These are very in-depth, get-to-know-you kind of interviews that usually go for an hour. Next week, we're talking to Kelly Aya on Monday and Jim Rubens on Thursday. So if you're interested, tune in at unionleader.com.
Yeah, and I'm with Casey. I think it's going to be interesting to see whether there is anything that changes the narrative that seems to kind of be solidifying about the presidential race and also the races here in the state. It's all politics at this point.
All right, thanks for joining us, everyone. Have a good weekend. I'm Josh Rogers. This is The Exchange on NHPR.